St. Anthony's. In the flickering light of hundreds of sacramental candles, he saw that the walls were bare, stripped of all their ornaments, of the plaques for the Stations of the Cross. The dark wood along the wall was scarred and gouged wherever there had been anything remotely resembling a cross. The floor, too, was mostly bare. The pews ripped from their neat rows and hacked to pieces, their splintered remains piled high at the rear under the choir balcony. And the giant crucifix that had dominated the space behind the altar, only a portion of it remained. The cross pieces on each side had been sawed off, and so now an armless, life-size Christ hung upside down against the rear wall of the sanctuary. Joe took in all that in a flash. Then his attention was drawn to the unholy congregation that peopled St. Anthony's this night. The collaborators, the Vichy humans, as Zev called them, made up the periphery of the group. They looked like normal, everyday people, but each was wearing a crescent moon earring. But the others, the group gathered in the sanctuary. Joe felt his hackles rise at the sight of them. They surrounded the altar in a tight knot, their pale, bestial faces, bereft of the slightest trace of human warmth, compassion, or decency, were turned upward. His gorge rose when he saw the object of their rapt attention. A naked teenage boy, his hands tied behind his back, was suspended over the altar by his ankles. He was sobbing and choking, his eyes wide and vacant with shock, his mind all but gone. The skin had been flayed from his forehead. Apparently the Vichy had found an expedient solution to the cross tattoo, and blood ran in a slow stream down his abdomen and chest from his freshly truncated genitals. And beside him, standing atop the altar, a bloody-mouthed creature dressed in a long cassock. Joe recognized the thin shoulders, the graying hair trailing from the balding crown, but was shocked at the crimson vulpine grin he flashed to the things clustered below him. "Now," said the creature, in a lightly accented voice Joe had heard hundreds of times from St. Anthony's pulpit, "Father Alberto Palmieri." And from the group a hand reached up with a straight razor and drew it across the boy's throat. As the blood flowed down over his face, those below squeezed and struggled forward like hatchling vultures to catch the falling drops and scarlet trickles in their open mouths. Joe fell away from the window and vomited. He felt Zev grab his arm and lead him away. He was vaguely aware of crossing the street and heading toward the ruined legal office. Part 5. "Why in God's name did you want me to see that?" Zev looked across the office toward the source of the words. He could see a vague outline where Father Joe sat on the floor, his back against the wall, the open bottle of scotch in his hand. The priest had taken one drink since their return, no more. "I thought you should know what they were doing to your church." "So you've said, but what's the reason behind that one?" Zev shrugged in the darkness. "I'd heard you weren't doing well. That even before everything else began falling apart, you had already fallen apart. So, when I felt it safe to get away, I came to see you. Just as I expected, I found a man who was angry at everything and letting it eat up his gudarim. I thought maybe it would be good to give that man something very specific to be angry at."
"You bastard," Father Joe whispered. "Who gave you the right?"
"Friendship gave me the right, Joe. I should hear that you are rotting away and do nothing. I have no congregation of my own anymore, so I turned my attention on you. Always I was a somewhat meddlesome rabbi."
"Still are. Out to save my soul, eh?"
"We rabbis don't save souls. Guide them, maybe, hopefully give them direction. But only you can save your soul, Joe." Silence hung in the air for a while. Suddenly, the crescent moon earring Zev had given Father Joe landed in the puddle of moonlight on the floor between them.
"Why do they do it?" the priest said. "The Vishi. Why do they collaborate?"
"The first were quite unwilling, believe me. They cooperated because their wives and children were held hostage by the vampires. But before too long, the dregs of humanity began to slither out from under their rocks and offer their services in exchange for the immortality of vampirism."
"Why bother working for them? Why not just bare your throat to the nearest bloodsucker?"
"That's what I thought at first," Zev said. "But as I witnessed the Lakewood Holocaust, I detected the vampire's pattern. They can choose who joins their ranks, so after they've fully infiltrated the population, they change their tactics. You see, they don't want too many of their kind concentrated in one area. It's like too many carnivores in one forest. When the herds of prey are wiped out, the predators starve. So they start to employ a different style of killing. For only when the vampire draws the life's blood from the throat with its fangs does the victim become one of them. Anyone drained as in the manner of the boy in the church tonight dies a true death. He's as dead now as someone run over by a truck. He will not rise tomorrow night."
"I get it," Father Joe said. "The Vishi trade their daylight services and dirty work to the vampires now for immortality later on."
"Correct."
There was no humor in the soft laugh that echoed across the room from Father Joe.
"Swell. I never cease to be amazed at our fellow human beings. Their capacity for good is exceeded only by their ability to debase themselves. Hopelessness does strange things, Joe. The vampires know that, so they rob us of hope. That's how they beat us. They transform our friends and neighbors and leaders into their own, leaving us feeling alone, completely cut off. Some of us can't take the despair and kill ourselves."
"Hopelessness," Joe said. "A potent weapon."
After a long silence, Zev said, "So, what are you going to do now, Father Joe?"
Another bitter laugh from across the room. "I suppose this is the place where I declare that I've found new purpose in life and will now go forth into the world as a fearless vampire killer."
"Such a thing would be nice."
"Well, screw that. I'm only going as far as across the street."
"To St. Anthony's?"
Zev saw Father Joe take a swig from the scotch bottle and then screw the cap on tight.
"Yeah, to see if there's anything I can do over there." "Father Palmieri and his nest might not like that."
"I told you, don't call him father, and screw him! Nobody can do what he's done and get away with it. I'm taking my church back."
In the dark, behind his beard, Zev smiled.
Part 6. Joe stayed up the rest of the night and let Zev sleep. The old guy needed his rest. Sleep would have been impossible for Joe anyway. He was too wired. He sat up and watched St. Anthony's. They left before first light, dark shapes drifting out the front doors and down the stone steps like parishioners leaving a pre-dawn service. Joe felt his back teeth grind as he scanned the group for Palmieri, but he couldn't make him out in the dimness. By the time the sun began to peek over the rooftops and through the trees to the east, the street outside was deserted. He woke Zev and together they approached the church. The heavy oak and iron front doors, each forming half of a pointed arch, were closed. He pulled them open and fastened the hooks to keep them open. Then he walked through the vestibule and into the nave. Even though he was ready for it, the stench backed him up a few steps. When his stomach settled, he forced himself ahead,
treading a path between the two piles of shattered and splintered pews. Zev walked beside him, a handkerchief pressed over his mouth. Last night he had thought the place a shambles. He saw now that it was worse. The light of day poked into all the corners, revealing everything that had been hidden by the warm glow of the candles. Half a dozen rotting corpses hung from the ceiling. He hadn't noticed them last night. And others were sprawled on the floor against the walls. Some of the bodies were in pieces. Behind the chancel rail, a headless female torso was draped over the front of the pulpit. To the left stood the statue of Mary. Someone had fitted her with foam rubber breasts and a huge dildo. At the rear of the sanctuary was the armless Christ hanging head down on the upright of his cross. "My church," he whispered as he moved along the path that had once been the center aisle, the aisle brides used to walk down with their fathers. "Look what they've done to my church." Joe approached the huge block of the altar. Once it had been backed against the far wall of the sanctuary, but he'd had it moved to the front so that he could celebrate Mass facing his parishioners. Solid Carrara marble. But you'd never know it now. So caked with dried blood, semen, and feces, it could have been made of styrofoam. His revulsion was fading, melting away in the growing heat of his rage, drawing the nausea with it. He had intended to clean up the place, but there was so much to be done, too much for two men. It was hopeless. "Father Joe?" He spun at the sound of the strange voice. A thin figure stood uncertainly in the open doorway. A man of about 50 edged forward timidly. "Father Joe? Is that you?" Joe recognized him now. Carl Edwards. A twitchy little man who used to help pass the collection basket at 10:30 Mass on Sundays. A transplantee from Jersey City. Hardly anyone around here was originally from around here. His face was sunken, his eyes feverish as he stared at Joe. "Yes, Carl, it's me." "Oh, thank God." He ran forward and dropped to his knees before Joe. He began to sob. "You come back. Thank God you come back." Joe pulled him to his feet. "Come on now, Carl. Get a grip. You come back to save us, ain't you? God sent you here to punish him, didn't he?"
"Punish whom?"
"Father Palmieri. He's wanted him. He's to waste all of him.
I know," Joe said. "I know."
"Oh, it's so good to have you back, Father Joe. We ain't know what to do since the suckers took over. We've been praying for someone like you, and now you're here. It's a freaking miracle."
Joe wanted to ask Carl where he and all these people who seemed to think they needed him now had been when he was being railroaded out of the parish. But that was ancient history.
"Not a miracle, Carl," Joe said, glancing at Zev. "Rabbi Wolpin brought me back."
As Carl and Zev shook hands, Joe said, "And I'm just passing through."
"Passing through? No, that can't be. You gotta stay."
Joe saw the light of hope fading in the little man's eyes. Something twisted within him, tugging him.
"What can I do here, Carl? I'm just one man."
"I'll help. I'll do whatever you want. Just tell me."
"Will you help me clean up?" Carl looked around and seemed to see the cadavers for the first time. He cringed and turned a few shades paler.
"Yeah, sure, anything."
Joe looked at Zev.
"Well, what do you think?"
Zev shrugged. "I should tell you what to do? My parish, it's not..."
"Not mine either."
Zev jetted his beard at Carl.
"I think maybe he'd tell you differently."
Joe did a slow turn. The vaulted nave was utterly silent except for the buzzing of the flies around the cadavers. A massive cleanup job. But if they worked all day, they could make a decent dent in it. And then what? Joe didn't know.
He was playing this by ear. He'd wait and see what the night brought. Can you get us some food, Carl? I'd sell my soul for a cup of coffee. Carl gave him a strange look. Just a figure of speech, Carl. We'll need some food if we're going to keep working. The man's eyes lit again.
That means you're staying?
For a while.
I'll get you some food, he said excitedly as he ran for the door. And coffee. I know someone who's still got coffee. She'll part with some of it for Father Joe.
He stopped at the door and turned.
Hey, and Father? I never believed any of them things that were said about you. Never.
Joe tried, but he couldn't hold it back. Would have meant a lot to have heard that from you last year, Carl. The man lowered his eyes.
Yeah, I guess it would have.
But I'll make it up to you, Father. I will.
You could take that to the bank.
Then he was out the door and gone. Joe turned to Zev and saw the old man rolling up his sleeves.
No, Zev said. The bodies. Before we do anything else, I think maybe we should move the bodies.
Part 7. By early afternoon, Zev was exhausted. The heat and the heavy work had taken their toll. He had to stop and rest. He sat on the chancel rail and looked around. Nearly 8 hours' work, and they'd barely scratched the surface. But the place did look and smell better. Removing the fly-blown corpses and scattered body parts had been the worst of it. A foul, gut-roiling task that had taken most of the morning. They'd carried the corpses out to the small graveyard behind the church and left them there. Those people deserved a decent burial, but there was no time for it today. Once the corpses were gone, Father Joe had torn the defilements from the statue of Mary, and then they'd turned their attention to the huge crucifix. It took a while, but they finally found Christ's plaster arms in the pile of ruined pews. They were still nailed to the sawn-off crosspiece of the crucifix. While Zev and Father Joe worked at jury-rigging a series of braces to reattach the arms, Carl found a mop and bucket and began the long, slow process of washing the fouled floor of the nave. Now the crucifix was intact again. The life-size plaster Jesus had his arms reattached and was once again nailed to his refurbished cross. Father Joe and Carl had restored him to his former position of dominance. The poor man was upright again, hanging over the center of the sanctuary in all his tortured splendor. A grisly sight. Zev could never understand the Catholic attachment to these gruesome statues. But if the vampires loathed them, then Zev was for them all the way. His stomach rumbled with hunger. At least they'd had a good breakfast. Carl had returned from his food run this morning with bread, cheese, and 2 thermoses of hot coffee. He wished now they'd saved some. Maybe there was a crust of bread left in the sack. He headed back to the vestibule to check and found an aluminum pot and a paper bag sitting by the door. The pot was full of beef stew, and the sack contained 3 cans of Pepsi. He poked his head out the doors, but no one was in sight on the street outside. It had been that way all day. He'd spy a figure or two peeking in the front doors. They'd hover there for a moment as if to confirm what they had heard was true. Then they'd scurry away. He looked at the meal that had been left. A group of the locals must have donated from their hoard of canned stew and precious soft drinks to fix this. Zev was touched. He called Father Joe and Carl. "Tastes like Dinty Moore," Father Joe said around a mouthful of the stew.
"It is," Carl said. "I recognize little potatoes. The ladies of the parish must really be excited about you coming back to break into their canned goods like this."
They were feasting in the sacristy, the small room off the sanctuary where the priests had kept their vestments, a clerical green room, so to speak. Zev found the stew palatable, but much too salty. He wasn't about to complain, though.
"I don't believe I've ever had anything like this before."
"I'd be real surprised if you had," said Father Joe. "I doubt very much that something that calls itself Dinty Moore is kosher." Zev smiled, but inside he was suddenly filled with a great sadness. Kosher. How meaningless now seemed all the observances which he had allowed to rule and circumscribe his life. such a fierce proponent of strict dietary laws he'd been in the days before the Lakewood Holocaust. But those days were gone, just as the Lakewood community was gone. And Zev was a changed man. If he hadn't changed, if he were still observing, he couldn't sit here and sup with these two men. He'd have to be elsewhere, eating special classes of specially prepared foods, off separate sets of dishes. But really, wasn't division what holding to the dietary laws in modern times was all about? They served a purpose beyond mere observance of tradition. They placed another wall between observant Jews and outsiders, keeping them separate, even from other Jews who didn't observe. Zev forced himself to take a big bite of the stew. Time to break down all the walls between people, while there was still enough time and people left alive to make it matter.
"You okay, Zev?" Father Joe asked.
Zev nodded silently, afraid to speak for fear of sobbing. Despite all its anachronisms, he missed his life in the good old days of last year. Gone. It was all gone. The rich traditions, the culture, the friends, the prayers. He felt adrift, in time and in space. Nowhere was home.
"You sure?" The young priest seemed genuinely concerned.
"Yes, I'm okay as you could expect me to feel after spending the better part of the day repairing a crucifix and eating non-kosher food. And let me tell you, that's not so okay."
He put his bowl aside and straightened from his chair.
"Come on already. Let's get back to work. There's much yet to do."
Part 8.
"Sun's almost down," Carl said. Joe straightened from scrubbing the altar and stared west through one of the smashed windows. The sun was out of sight behind the houses there.
"You can go now, Carl," he said to the little man. "Thanks for your help."
"Where you's gonna go, Father?"
"I'll be staying right here." Carl's prominent Adam's apple bobbed convulsively as he swallowed.
"Yeah? Well, then I'm staying too. I told you I'd make it up to you, didn't I? Besides, I don't think the suckles will like the new improved St. Anthony's too much when they come back tonight, do you? I don't even think they'll get through the doors."
Joe smiled at the man and looked around. Luckily, it was July when the days were long. They'd had time to make a difference here. The floors were clean, the crucifix was restored and back in its proper position, as were most of the stations of the cross plaques. Zev had found them under the pews and had taken the ones not shattered beyond recognition and rehung them on the walls. Lots of new crosses littered those walls. Carl had found a hammer and nails and had made dozens of them from the remains of the pews.
"No, I don't think they'll like the new decor one bit.
But there's something you can get us if you can, Carl. Guns. Pistols, rifles, shotguns, anything that shoots." Carl nodded slowly.
"I know a few guys who can help in that department.
And some wine, a little red wine if anybody saved some."
"You got it."
He hurried off.
"You're planning Custer's last stand, maybe?" Zev said from where he was tacking the last of Carl's crude crosses to the east wall.
"More like the Alamo."
"Same result,"
Zev said with one of his shrugs. Joe turned back to scrubbing the altar. He'd been at it for over an hour now. He was drenched with sweat and knew he smelled like a bear, but he couldn't stop until it was clean. An hour later, he was forced to give up. No use. It wouldn't come clean. The vampires must have done something to the blood and foulness to make the mixture seep into the surface of the marble like it had. He sat on the floor with his back against the altar and rested. He didn't like resting, because it gave him time to think, and when he started to think, he realized that the odds were pretty high against his seeing tomorrow morning. At least he'd die well fed. Their secret supplier had left them a dinner of fresh fried chicken by the front doors. Even the memory of it made his mouth water. Apparently someone was really glad he was back. To tell the truth, though, as miserable as he'd been, he wasn't ready to die. Not tonight,
Not any night. He wasn't looking for an Alamo or a little bighorn. All he wanted to do was hold off the vampires till dawn. Keep them out of St. Anthony's for one night, that was all. That would be a statement. His statement. If he found an opportunity to ram a stake through Palmieri's rotten heart, so much the better, but he wasn't counting on that. One night. Just to let them know they couldn't have their way everywhere with everybody whenever they felt like it. He had a surprise on his side tonight, so maybe it would work. One night. Then he'd be on his way.
What the fuck have you done?
Joe looked up at the shout. A burly, long-haired man in jeans and a flannel shirt stood in the vestibule staring at the partially restored nave. As he approached, Joe noticed his crescent moon earring. A Vichy. Joe balled his fists but didn't move.
Hey! I'm talking to you, mister! Are you responsible for this?
When all he got from Joe was a cold stare, he turned to Ziv.
Hey, you! Jew! What the hell do you think you're doing?
He started toward Ziv.
You get those fucking crosses off! Touch him, and I'll break you in half, Joe said in a low voice.
The Vichy skidded to a halt and stared at him.
Hey, asshole! Are you crazy? Do you know what Father Palmieri will do to you when he arrives? Father Palmieri? Why do you still call him that?
It's what he wants to be called. And he's going to call you dog meat when he gets here. Joe pulled himself to his feet and looked down at the Vichy. The man took two steps back. Suddenly, he didn't seem so sure of himself. Tell him I'll be waiting. Tell him Father Cahill is back.
You're a priest? You don't look like one. Shut up and listen.
Tell him Father Joe Cahill is back. And he's pissed. Tell him that. Now get out of here while you still can. The man turned and hurried into the growing darkness. Joe turned to Zev and found him grinning through his beard.
Father Joe Cahill is back. And he's pissed. I like that.
We'll make it into a bumper sticker. Meanwhile, let's close those doors. The criminal element is starting to wander in. I'll see if we can find some more candles. It's getting dark in here. Part 9. He wore the night like a tuxedo. Dressed in a fresh cassock, Father Alberto Palmieri turned off County Line Road and strolled toward St. Anthony's. The night was lovely, especially when you owned it. And he owned the night in this area of Lakewood now. He loved the night. He felt at one with it, attuned to its harmonies and its discords. The darkness made him feel so alive. Strange to have to lose your life before you could really feel alive. But this was it. He found his niche, his métier. Such a shame it had taken him so long. All those years trying to deny his appetites, trying to be a member of the other side, cursing himself when he allowed his appetites to win, as he had with increasing frequency toward the end of his mortal life. He should have given in to them completely long ago. It had taken undeath to free him. And to think he had been afraid of undeath, had cowered in fear each night in the cellar of the church, surrounded by crosses. Fortunately, he had not been as safe as he'd thought, and one of the beings he now called brother was able to slip in on him in the dark while he dozed. He saw now that he had lost nothing but his blood by that encounter, and in trade, he'd gained a world. For now it was his world, at least this little corner of it, one in which he was completely free to indulge himself in any way he wished, except for the blood, He had no choice about the blood. That was a new appetite, stronger than all the rest, one that would not be denied. But he did not mind the new appetite in the least. He'd found interesting ways to sate it. Up ahead, he spotted dear, defiled St. Anthony's. He wondered what his servants had prepared for him tonight. They were quite imaginative. They'd yet to bore him. But as he drew nearer the church, Palmieri slowed. His skin prickled. The building had changed. Something was very wrong there. Wrong inside. Something amiss with the light that beamed from the windows. This wasn't the old familiar candlelight. This was something else. Something more. Something that made his insides tremble. Figures raced up the street toward him, live ones. His night vision picked out the earrings and familiar faces of some of his servants. As they neared, he sensed the warmth of the blood coursing just beneath their skins. The hunger rose in him, and he fought the urge to rip into one of their throats. He couldn't allow himself that pleasure. He had to keep the servants dangling, keep them working for him in the nest. They needed the services of the indentured living to remove whatever obstacles the cattle might put in their way. "Father, Father," they cried. He loved it when they called him Father. Loved being one of the undead and dressing like one of the enemy. "Yes, my children. What sort of victim do you have for us tonight?" "No victim, Father. Trouble." The edges of Palmieri's vision darkened with rage as he heard of the young priest and the Jew who had dared to try to turn St. Anthony's into a holy place again. When he heard the name of the priest, he nearly exploded. "Cahill! Joseph Cahill is back in my church. He was cleaning the altar," one of the servants said. Palmieri strode toward the church with the servants trailing behind. He knew that neither Cahill nor the Pope himself could clean that altar. Palmieri had desecrated it himself. He had learned how to do that when he became nest leader. But what else had the young pup dared to do? Whatever it was, it would be undone now. Palmieri strode up the steps and pulled the right door open and screamed in agony, "The light! The light! The light!" White agony lanced through Palmieri's eyes and seared his brain like two hot pokers. He retched and threw his arms across his face as he staggered back into the cool, comforting darkness. It took a few minutes for the pain to drain off, for the nausea to pass, for vision to return. He'd never understand it. He'd spent his entire life in the presence of crosses and crucifixes, surrounded by them. And yet as soon as he'd become undead, he was unable to bear the sight of one. As a matter of fact, since he'd become undead, he'd never even seen one. A cross was no longer an object, it was a light. A light so excruciatingly bright, so blazingly white that it was sheer agony to look at it. As a child in Naples, he'd been told by his mother not to look at the sun. But when there'd been talk of an eclipse, he'd stared directly into its eye. The pain of looking at the cross was 1,000 times worse than that. And the bigger the cross or crucifix, the worse the pain. He'd experienced monumental pain upon looking into St. Anthony's tonight. That could only mean that Joseph, that young bastard, had refurbished the giant crucifix. It was the only possible explanation. He swung on his servants. "Get in there! Get that crucifix down. They've got guns. Then get help, but get it down. We'll get guns too. We can..." "No. I want him. I want that priest alive. I want him for myself. Anyone who kills him will suffer a very painful, very long and lingering true death. Is that clear?" It was clear. They scurried away without answering. Palmieri went to gather the other members of the nest. Part 10. Dressed in a cassock and a surplice, Joe came out of the sacristy and approached the altar. He noticed Zev keeping watch at one of the windows. He didn't tell him how ridiculous he looked carrying the shotgun Carl had brought back. He held it so gingerly, like it was full of nitroglycerin and would explode if he jiggled it. Zev turned and smiled when he saw him.
"Now you look like the old Father Joe we all used to know."
Joe gave him a little bow and proceeded toward the altar. All right. He had everything he needed. He had the missile they'd found in among the pew debris earlier today. He had the wine. Carl had brought back about 4 ounces of sour red barberoni. He found a smudged surplice and a dusty cassock on the floor of one of the closets in the sacristy, and he wore them now. No hosts, though. A crust of bread left over from breakfast would have to do. No chalice, either. If he'd known he was going to be saying Mass, he'd have come prepared. As a last resort, he'd used the can opener in the rectory to remove the top from one of the Pepsi cans from lunch. Quite a stretch from the gold chalice he'd used since his ordination, but probably more in line with what Jesus had used at that first Mass, the Last Supper. He was uncomfortable with the idea of weapons in St. Anthony's, but he saw no alternative. He and Zev knew nothing about guns, and Carl knew little more. They'd probably do more damage to themselves than to the Vichy if they tried to use them, but maybe the sight of them would make the Vichy hesitate, slow them down. All he needed was a little time here, enough to get to the consecration. This is going to be the most unusual Mass in history, he thought. But he was going to get through it if it killed him. And that was a real possibility. This might well be his last Mass. But he wasn't afraid. He was too excited to be afraid. He'd had a slug of the scotch, just enough to ward off the DTs, but it had done nothing to quell the buzz of the adrenaline humming along every nerve in his body. He spread everything out on the white tablecloth he'd taken from the rectory and used to cover the filthy altar. He looked at Carl. Ready? Carl nodded and stuck the .38 caliber pistol he'd been examining in his belt.
Been a while, Fada. We did it in Latin when I was a kid, but I think I can swing it.
Just do your best and don't worry about any mistakes. Some Mass. A defiled altar. A crust for a host. A Pepsi can for a chalice. A 50-year-old pistol-packing altar boy. And a congregation consisting of a lone, shotgun-carrying Orthodox Jew. Joe looked heavenward. You do understand, don't you, Lord, that this was arranged on short notice? Time to begin. He read the gospel but dispensed with the homily. He tried to remember the Mass as it used to be said, to fit in better with Carl's outdated responses. As he was starting the offertory, the front doors flew open and a group of men entered, 10 of them, all with crescent moons dangling from their ears. Out of the corner of his eye, he saw Zev move away from the window toward the altar, pointing his shotgun at them. As soon as they entered the nave and got past the broken pews, the Vichy fanned out toward the sides. They began pulling down the stations of the cross, ripping Carl's makeshift crosses from the walls and tearing them apart. Carl looked up at Joe from where he knelt, his eyes questioning, his hand reaching for the pistol in his belt. Joe shook his head and kept up with the offertory. When all the little crosses were down, the Vichy swarmed behind the altar. Joe chanced a quick glance over his shoulder and saw them begin their attack on the newly repaired crucifix.
"Zev," Carl said in a low voice, cocking his head toward the Vichy. "Stop him!"
Zev worked the pump on the shotgun. The sound echoed through the church. Joe heard the activity behind him come to a sudden halt. He braced himself for the shot, but it never came. He looked at Zev. The old man met his gaze and sadly shook his head. He couldn't do it. To the accompaniment of the sound of renewed activity and derisive laughter behind him, Joe gave Zev a tiny nod of reassurance and understanding, then hurried the Mass toward the consecration. As he held the crust of bread aloft, He started at the sound of the life-size crucifix crashing to the floor, cringed as he heard the freshly buttressed arms and crosspiece being torn away again. As he held the wine aloft in the Pepsi can, the swaggering, grinning Vichy surrounded the altar and brazenly tore the cross from around his neck. Zev and Carl put up a struggle to keep theirs, but were overpowered. And then Joe's skin began to crawl as a new group entered the nave. There had to be at least 40 of them, all of them vampires. And Palmieri was leading them. Part 11. Palmieri hid his hesitancy as he approached the altar. The crucifix and its intolerable whiteness were gone, yet something was not right. Something repellent here. Something that urged him to flee. What? Perhaps it was just the residual effect of the crucifix and all the crosses they had used to line the walls. That had to be it. The unsettling aftertaste would fade as the night wore on. Oh, yes, his night brothers and sisters from the nest would see to that. He focused his attention on the man behind the altar and laughed when he realized what he held in his hands. Pepsi, Joseph. You're trying to consecrate Pepsi? He turned to his nest siblings. Do you see this? My brothers and sisters. Is this the man we are to fear? And look who he has with him, an old Jew and a parish hanger-on. He heard their hissing laughter as they fanned out around him, sweeping toward the altar in a wide phalanx. The Jew and Carl, he recognized Carl and wondered how he'd avoided capture for so long. Retreated to the other side of the altar where they flanked Joseph. And Joseph. Joseph's handsome Irish face so pale and drawn. His mouth drawn into such a tight, grim line. He looked scared to death. And well he should be. Palmieri put down his rage at Joseph's audacity. He was glad he had returned. He'd always hated the young priest for his easy manner with people, for the way the parishioners had flocked to him with their problems, despite the fact that he had nowhere near the experience of their older and wiser pastor. But that was over now. That world was gone, replaced by a night world, Palmieri's world, and no one would be flocking to Father Joe for anything when Palmieri was through with him. Father Joe. How he'd hated it when the parishioners had started calling him that. Well, their Father Joe would provide superior entertainment tonight. This was going to be fun. Joseph, 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 he said as he stopped and smiled at the young priest across the altar. This futile gesture is so typical of your arrogance. But Joseph only stared back at him, his expression a mixture of defiance and repugnance, and that only fueled Palmieri's rage. Do I repel you, Joseph? Does my new form offend your precious shanty Irish sensibilities? Does my undeath disgust you? You managed to do all that while you were still alive, Alberto. Palmieri allowed himself to smile. Joseph probably thought he was putting on a brave front, but the tremor in his voice betrayed his fear. Always good with the quick retort, weren't you, Joseph? Always thinking you were better than me. Always putting yourself above me. Not much of a climb where a child molester is concerned. Palmieri's anger mounted. So superior. So self-righteous. What about your appetites, Joseph? The secret ones. What are they? Do you always hold them in check?
Are you so far above the rest of us that you never give in to an improper impulse? I'll bet you think that even if we made you one of us, you could resist the blood hunger.
He saw by the startled look in Joseph's face that he had struck a nerve. He stepped closer, almost touching the altar.
You do, don't you? You really think you could resist it? Well, we shall see about that, Joseph. By dawn, you'll be drained. We'll each take a turn at you. And when the sun rises, you'll have to hide from its light. When the night comes, you'll be one of us. And then all the rules will be off. The night will be yours. You'll be able to do anything and everything you've ever wanted. But the blood hunger will be on you, too. You won't be sipping your God's blood as you've done so often, but human blood. You'll thirst for hot human blood, Joseph. And you'll have to sate that thirst. There'll be no choice. And I want to be there when you do, Joseph. I want to be there to laugh in your face as you suck up the crimson nectar and keep on laughing every night as the red hunger lures you into infinity. And it would happen. Palmieri knew it as sure as he felt his own thirst. He hungered for the moment when he could rub dear Joseph's face in the muck of his own despair.
I was about to finish saying Mass, Joseph said coolly. Do you mind if I finish?
Palmieri couldn't help laughing this time.
Did you really think this charade would work? Did you really think you could celebrate Mass on this?
He reached out and snatched the tablecloth from the altar, sending the missal on the piece of bread to the floor and exposing the fouled surface of the marble.
Did you really think you could effect the transubstantiation here? Do you really believe any of that garbage? That the bread and wine actually take on the substance of...
He tried to say the name, but it wouldn't form.
The Son's body and blood.
One of the Nest brothers, Frederick, stepped forward and leaned over the altar, smiling.
Transubstantiation,
he said in his most unctuous voice, pulling the Pepsi can from Joseph's hands.
Does that mean that this is the blood of the Son?
A whisper of warning slithered through Palmieri's mind. Something about the can. Something about the way he found it difficult to bring its outline into focus.
Brother Frederick, maybe you should...
Frederick's grin broadened.
I've always wanted to sup on the blood of a deity.
The Nest members hissed their laughter as Frederick raised the can and drank. Palmieri was jolted by the explosion of intolerable brightness that burst from Frederick's mouth. The inside of his skull glowed beneath his scalp, and shafts of pure white light shot from his ears, nose, eyes, every orifice in his head. The glow spread as it flowed down through his throat and chest and into his abdominal cavity, silhouetting his ribs before melting through his skin. Frederick was liquefying where he stood, his flesh steaming, softening, running like glowing molten lava.
No! This couldn't be happening! Not when he had Joseph in his grasp!
Then the can fell from Frederick's dissolving fingers and landed on the altar top. Its contents splashed across the fouled surface, releasing another detonation of brilliance, this one more devastating than the first. The glare spread rapidly, extending over the upper surface and running down the sides, moving like a living thing, engulfing the entire altar, making it glow like a corpuscle of fire torn from the heart of the sun itself. And with the light came blast furnace heat that drove Palmieri back, back, back,
until he had to turn and follow the rest of his nest in a mad headlong rush from St. Anthony's into the cool, welcoming safety of the outer darkness.
Part 12. As the vampires fled into the night, their vichy toadies behind them, Zev stared in horrid fascination at the puddle of putrescence that was all that remained of the vampire Palmieri had called Frederick. He glanced at Carl and caught the look of dazed wonderment on his face. Zev touched the top of the altar. Clean. Shiny. Every whorl of the marble surface clearly visible. There was fearsome power here. Incalculable power. But instead of elating him, the realization only depressed him. How long had this been going on? Did it happen at every mass? Why had he spent his entire life ignorant of this? He turned to Father Joe. What happened?
I don't know.
A miracle, Carl said, running his palm over the altar top.
A miracle and a meltdown, Father Joe said.
He picked up the empty Pepsi can and looked into it. You know, you go through the seminary, through your ordination, through countless masses believing in the transubstantiation. But after all these years, to actually know.
Zev saw him rub his finger along the inside of the can and taste it. He grimaced.
What's wrong? Zev asked.
Still tastes like sour barberoni, with a hint of Pepsi.
Doesn't matter what it tastes like. As far as Palmieri and his friends are concerned, it's the real thing.
No, said the priest with a small smile. That's Coke. And then they started laughing. It wasn't that funny, but Zev found himself roaring along with the other two. It was more a release of tension than anything else. His sides hurt. He had to lean against the altar to support himself. It took the return of the Vichy to cure the laughter. They charged in carrying a heavy fire blanket. This time Father Joe did not stand by passively as they invaded his church. He stepped around the altar and met them head on. He was great and terrible as he confronted them. His giant stature and raised fists cowed them for a few heartbeats, but then they must have remembered that they outnumbered him 12-1 and charged him. He swung a massive fist and caught the lead Vichy square on the jaw. The blow lifted him off his feet and he landed against another. Both went down. Zev dropped to one knee and reached for the shotgun. He would use it this time. He would shoot these vermin, he swore it. But then someone landed on his back and drove him to the floor. As he tried to get up, he saw Father Joe, surrounded, swinging his fists, laying the Vichy out every time he connected, but there were too many. As the priest went down under the press of them, a heavy boot thudded against the side of Zev's head. He sank into darkness. Part 13. A throbbing in his head, stinging pain in his cheek, and a voice, sibilant, yet harsh.
Now, Joseph, come on, wake up. I don't want you to miss this.
Palmieri's sallow features swam into view, hovering over him, grinning like a skull. Joe tried to move, but found his wrists and arms tied. His right hand throbbed, felt twice its normal size. He must have broken it on a Vichy jaw. He lifted his head and saw that he was tied spread eagle on the altar, and that the altar had been covered with the fire blanket.
Melodramatic, I admit, Palmieri said, but fitting, don't you think? I mean, you and I used to sacrifice our God symbolically here every weekday and multiple times on Sundays. So why shouldn't this serve as your sacrificial altar?
Joe shut his eyes against a wave of nausea. This couldn't be happening.
Thought you'd won, didn't you?
when Joe wouldn't answer and Palmieri went on. And even if you chased me out of here for good, what would you have accomplished? The world is ours now, Joseph. Feeders and cattle. That is the hierarchy. We are the feeders. And tonight, you'll join us. But he won't. Voila! He stepped aside and made a flourish toward the balcony. Joe searched the dim, candlelit space of the nave, not sure what he was supposed to see. Then he picked out Zev's form and he groaned. The old man's feet were lashed to the balcony rail. He hung upside down. His reddened face and frightened eyes turned his way. Joe fell back and strained at the ropes, but they wouldn't budge.
Let him go!
What? And let all that good, rich Jewish blood go to waste? Why, these people are the chosen of God. They're a delicacy.
Bastard. If he could just get his hands on Palmieri just for a minute.
Tut-tut, Joseph. Not in the house of the Lord. The Jew should have been smart and run away like Carl.
Carl got away. Good. The poor guy would probably hate himself, call himself a coward the rest of his life, but he'd done what he could. Better to live on than get strung up like Zev.
We're even, Carl. But don't worry about your rabbi. None of us will lay a fang on him. He hasn't earned the right to join us. We'll use the razor to bleed him. And when he's dead, he'll be dead for keeps. But not you, Joseph. Oh, no, not you.
His smile broadened.
You're mine.
Joe wanted to spit in Palmieri's face. Not so much as an act of defiance as to hide the waves of terror surging through him. But there was no saliva to be had in his parched mouth. The thought of being undead made him weak. To spend eternity like... He looked at the rapt faces of Palmieri's fellow vampires as they clustered under Zev's suspended form. Like them. He wouldn't be like them. He wouldn't allow it. But what if there was no choice? What if becoming undead toppled a lifetime's worth of moral constraints, cut all the tethers on his human hungers, negated all his mortal concepts of how a life should be lived, honor, justice, integrity, truth, decency, fairness, love? What if they became meaningless words instead of the footings for his life? A thought struck him. A deal, Alberto, he said.
You're hardly in a bargaining position, Joseph.
I'm not? Answer me this. Do the undead ever kill each other? I mean, has one of them ever driven a stake through another's heart?
No, of course not.
Are you sure? You'd better be sure before you go through with your plans tonight, because if I'm forced to become one of you, I'll be crossing over with just one thought in mind, to find you. And when I do, I won't stake your heart. I'll stake your arms and legs to the pilings of the Point Pleasant boardwalk where you can watch the sun rise and feel it slowly crisp your skin to charcoal.
Palmieri's smile wavered. Impossible. You'll be different. You'll want to thank me. You'll wonder why you ever resisted.
You better be sure of that, Alberto, for your sake. Because I'll have all eternity to track you down, and I'll find you, Alberto. I swear it on my own grave. Think on that. Do you think an empty threat is going to cow me? We'll find out how empty it is, won't we? But here's the deal. Let Zev go, and I'll let you be.
You care that much for an old Jew?
He's something you never knew in life, and never will know. He's a friend. And he gave me back my soul.
Palmieri leaned closer. His foul, nauseous breath wafted against Joe's face. A friend? How can you be friends with a dead man? With that, he straightened and turned toward the balcony.
Do him! Now!
As Joe shouted out frantic pleas and protests, one of the vampires climbed up the rubble toward Zev. Zev did not struggle. Joe saw him close his eyes, waiting. As the vampire reached out with the straight razor, Joe bit back a sob of grief and rage and helplessness. He was about to squeeze his own eyes shut when he saw a flame arc through the air from one of the windows. It struck the floor with a crash of glass and whomp of exploding flame. Joe had only heard of such things, but he immediately realized that he had just seen his first Molotov cocktail in action. The splattering gasoline caught the clothes of a nearby vampire who began running in circles, screaming as it beat at its flaming clothes. But its cries were drowned by the roar of other voices, 100 or more. Joe looked around and saw people, men, women, teenagers, climbing in the windows, charging through the front doors. The women held crosses on high while the men wielded long wooden pikes, broom, rake, and shovel handles whittled to sharp points. Joe recognized most of the faces from the Sunday masses he had held here for years. St. Anthony's parishioners were back to reclaim their church.
Yes!
He shouted, not sure of whether to laugh or cry. But when he saw the rage in Palmieri's face, he laughed.
Too bad, Alberto!
Palmieri made a lunge at his throat but cringed away as a woman with an upheld crucifix and a man with a pike charged the altar, Carl, and a woman Joe recognized as Mary O'Hare.
Told you I wouldn't let you down, didn't I, Father?
Carl said, grinning and pulling out a red Swiss Army knife. He began sawing at the rope around Joe's right wrist.
Didn't I?
That you did, Carl. I don't think I've ever been so glad to see anyone in my entire life, but how?
I told them. I run through the parish going house to house. I told him that Father Joe was in trouble and that we let him down before, but we shouldn't let him down again. He come back for us, and now we got to go back for him. Simple as that. And then they started running house to house, and before you know it, we had ourselves a little army. We come to kick ass, Father, if you'll excuse the expression.
Kick all the ass you can, Carl. Joe glanced at Mary O'Hare's terror-glazed eyes as she swiveled around, looking this way and that. He saw how the crucifix trembled in her hand. She wasn't going to kick too much ass in her state, but she was here. Dear God, she was here for him, and for St. Anthony's, despite the terror that so obviously filled her. His heart swelled with love for these people, and pride in their courage. As soon as his arms were free, Joe sat up and took the knife from Carl. As he sawed at his leg ropes, he looked around the church. The oldest and youngest members of the parishioner army were stationed at the windows and doors, where they held crosses aloft, cutting off the vampire's escape, while all across the nave, chaos. Screams, cries, and an occasional shot echoed through St. Anthony's. The vampires were outnumbered 3-1 and seemed blinded and confused by all the crosses around them. Despite their superhuman strength, it appeared that some were indeed getting their asses kicked. A number were already writhing on the floor, impaled on pikes. As Joe watched, he saw a pair of the women, crucifixes held before them, backing a vampire into a corner. As it cowered there with its arms across its face, one of the men charged in with a sharpened rake handle held like a lance and ran it through. But a number of parishioners lay in inert, bloody heaps on the floor, proof that the vampires and the Vichy were claiming their share of victims, too. Joe freed his feet and hopped off the altar. He looked around for Palmieri. He wanted Palmieri. But the vampire priest had lost himself in the melee. Joe glanced up at the balcony and saw that Zev was still hanging there, struggling to free himself. He started across the nave to help him. Part 14. Zev hated that he should be hung up here like a salami in a deli window. He tried again to pull his upper body up far enough to reach his leg ropes, but he couldn't get close. He'd never been one for exercise. Doing a sit-up flat on the floor would have been difficult, so what made him think he could do the equivalent maneuver hanging upside down by his feet? He dropped back, exhausted, and felt the blood rush to his head again. His vision swam, his ears pounded, he felt like the skin of his face was going to burst open. Much more of this and he'd have a stroke, or worse maybe. He watched the upside-down battle below and was glad to see the vampires getting the worst of it. These people, seeing Carl among them, Zev assumed they were part of St. Anthony's Parish, were ferocious, almost savage in their attacks on the vampires. Months' worth of pent-up rage and fear was being released upon their tormentors in a single burst. It was almost frightening. Suddenly, he felt a hand on his foot. Someone was untying his knots. Thank you, Lord. Soon he would be on his feet again. As the cords came loose, he decided he should at least attempt to participate in his own rescue. Once more, Zev thought. Once more I'll try. With a grunt, he levered himself up, straining, stretching to grasp something, anything. A hand came out of the darkness and he reached for it. But Zev's relief turned to horror when he felt the cold clamminess of the thing that clutched him. They pulled him up and over the balcony rail with inhuman strength. His bowels threatened to evacuate when Palmieri's grinning face loomed not 6 inches from his own.
"It's not over yet, Jew," he said softly, his foul breath clogging Zev's nose and throat. "Not by a long shot."
He felt Palmieri's free hand ram into his belly and grip his belt at the buckle, then the other hand grab a handful of his shirt at the neck. Before he could struggle or cry out, he was lifted free of the floor and hoisted over the balcony rail, and the demon's voice was in his ear.
"Joseph called you a friend, Jew. Let's see if he really meant it."
Part 15. Joe was halfway across the floor of the nave when he heard Palmieri's voice echo above the madness.
"Stop them, Joseph! Stop them now or I drop your friend!"
Joe looked up and froze. Palmieri stood at the balcony rail, leaning over it, his eyes averted from the nave and all its newly arrived crosses. At the end of his outstretched arms was Zev, suspended in midair over the splintered remains of the pews, over a particularly large and ragged spire of wood that pointed directly at the middle of Zev's back. Zev's frightened eyes were flashing between Joe and the giant spike below. Around him, Joe heard the sounds of the melee drop a notch, then drop another as all eyes were drawn to the tableau on the balcony.
"A human can die impaled on a wooden stake just as well as a vampire," Palmieri cried, "and just as quickly if it goes through his heart. But it can take hours of agony if it rips through his gut."
St. Anthony's grew silent as the fighting stopped, and each faction backed away to a different side of the church, leaving Joe alone in the middle.
"What do you want, Alberto?"
"First, I want all those crosses put away so that I can see."
Joe looked to his right where his parishioners stood. "Put them away," he told them. When a murmur of dissent arose, he added, "Don't put them down, just out of sight, please." Slowly, one by one at first, then in groups, the crosses and crucifixes were placed behind backs or tucked out of sight within coats. To his left, the vampires hissed their relief and the Vichy cheered. The sound was like hot needles being forced under Joe's fingernails. Above, Palmieri turned his face to Joe and smiled.
"That's better."
"What do you want?"
Joe asked, knowing with a sick crawling in his gut exactly what the answer would be.
"A trade," Palmieri said.
"Me for him, I suppose," Joe said.
Palmieri's smile broadened.
"Of course."
"No, Joe," Zev cried.
Palmieri shook the old man roughly. Joe heard him say,
"Quiet, Jew, or I'll snap your spine."
Then he looked down at Joe again.
"The other thing is to tell your rabble to let my people go."
He laughed and shook Zev again.
"You hear that, Jew? A biblical reference, Old Testament no less."
"All right," Joe said without hesitation. The parishioners on his right gasped as one, and cries of "No" and "You can't" filled San Anthony's. A particularly loud voice nearby shouted, "He's only a lousy kike!" Joe wheeled on the man and recognized Gene Harrington, a carpenter. He jerked a thumb back over his shoulder at the vampires and their servants. "You sound like you'd be more at home with them, Gene." Harrington backed up a step and looked at his feet. "Sorry, Father," he said in a voice that hovered on the verge of a sob, "but we just got you back." "I'll be all right," Joe said softly, and he meant it. Deep inside, he had a feeling that he would come through this, that if he could trade himself for Zev and face Palmieri one-on-one, he could come out the victor, or at least battle him to a draw. Now that he was no longer tied up like some sacrificial lamb, now that he was free, with full use of his arms and legs again, he could not imagine dying at the hands of the likes of Palmieri. Besides, one of the parishioners had given him a tiny crucifix. He had it closed in the palm of his hand. But he had to get Zev out of danger first. That above all else. He looked up at Palmieri. "All right, Alberto. I'm on my way up." "Wait," Palmieri said. "Someone search him." Joe gritted his teeth as one of the Vichy, a blubbery, unwashed slob, came forward and searched his pockets. Joe thought he might get away with a crucifix, but at the last moment he was made to open his hands. The Vichy grinned in Joe's face as he snatched the tiny cross from his palm and shoved it into his pocket. "He's clean now," the slob said, and gave Joe a shove toward the vestibule. Joe hesitated. He was walking into the snake pit unarmed now. A glance at his parishioners told him he couldn't very well turn back now. He continued on his way, clenching and unclenching his tense, sweaty fists as he walked. He still had a chance of coming out of this alive. He was too angry to die. He prayed that when he got within reach of the ex-priest, the smoldering rage at how he had framed him when he'd been pastor, at what he'd done to St. Anthony since then, would explode and give him the strength to tear Palmieri to pieces. "No!" Zev shouted from above. "Forget about me! You've started something here, and you've got to see it through!" Joe ignored his friend. "Coming, Alberto." "Father Joe's coming, Alberto, and he's pissed. Royally pissed." Part 16. Zev craned his neck around, watching Father Joe disappear beneath the balcony. "Joe! Come back!" Palmieri shook him again. "Give it up, old Jew. Joseph never listened to anyone, and he's not listening to you. He still believes in faith and virtue and honesty, in the power of goodness and truth over what he perceives as evil. He'll come up here ready to sacrifice himself for you, yet sure in his heart that he's going to win in the end. But he's wrong." "No," Zev said. But in his heart he knew that Palmieri was right. How could Joe stand up against a creature with Palmieri's strength? Who could hold Zev in the air like this for so long? Didn't his arms ever tire? "Yes," Palmieri hissed. "He's going to lose, and we're going to win. We'll win for the same reason we always win. We don't let anything as silly and transient as sentiment stand in our way. If we'd been winning below and situations were reversed, if Joseph were holding one of my Nest brothers over that wooden spike below, do you think I'd pause for a moment? For a second? Never! That's why this whole exercise by Joseph and these people is futile." Futile, Zev thought. Like much of his life, it seemed. Like all of his future. Joe would die tonight and Zev would live on, a cross-wearing Jew, with the traditions of his past sacked and in flames, and nothing in his future but a vast, empty, limitless plain to wander alone. There was a sound on the balcony stairs, and Palmieri turned his head.
Ah, Joseph, he said.
Zev couldn't see the priest, but he shuddered anyway.
Go back, Joe! Don't let him trick you!
Speaking of tricks,
Palmieri said, leaning further over the balcony rail as an extra warning to Joe.
I hope you're not going to try anything foolish.
No, said Joe's tired voice from somewhere behind Palmieri. No tricks. Pull him in and let him go. Zev could not let this happen, and suddenly